title of this message is When to Resist the Fight and When Not to Resist. Kind of like Shakespearean. When to fight or not to fight. To resist or not to resist. So to fight or not to fight. This came out of a discussion, which included a discussion with my grandchildren. Got me thinking about, take a second look at Daniel in the lion's den. When you think about Daniel in the lion's den, most of you know the story. His political enemies had put together a plot to prevent him from praying. Of course, Daniel, he, to the upper story of the house he lived in, with the window open toward the temple in Jerusalem, or where the temple used to sit, he would pray to the God of Israel, the Creator God, the true God, the real God. And if anybody were to look up in his window, they could see him in the window praying. Well, the question is, once they made this ordinance where no one could pray to anybody but that pagan statue, I guess with the emperor's face on it, for 30 days, kind of a loyalty test, because they were worried about loyalty and patriotism as they perceived it in the Persian Empire, but it was a trap for Daniel. Why didn't Daniel just back away from the window to some inner room, or back away where no one could see him in the window, or put a big curtain, down the window, or go to the basement, where he couldn't be seen, because it's just a prayer between him and God. Why did Daniel not alter his prayer pattern one iota, which he could have done for 30 days? And since prayer is private, it would not necessarily have been sinful. So that's the question. Why didn't Daniel do it? And the more I thought about that question, it got me thinking, this question of when to fight, when not to fight, when to resist, when not to resist. And, well, let's look at it and kind of investigate it. I'm going to read part of the story of Daniel. We'll start in 6, 4, and 5. But most of you know the story. Daniel 6:4. So the governors, satraps, sought to find some charge against Daniel concerning the kingdom, because he was the best of the administrators. We're going to be made prime minister over the other top ones. And, carnal jealousy and political, politics is a blood sport, as they say. They wanted to get Daniel. You'll see that in Washington, too, what I call legal traps to get your opponents. So, to find some charge against Daniel, but they could find no charge or fault. They probably looked for skimming money off the top, rewarding contracts only to his buddies, affairs with chief staff people. I'm sure they looked at every possible scandal, incompetence, mistakes. They could find no incompetence, no mistakes, no corruption. So notice what they said. They could find no charge or fault, because he was faithful, nor was there any error or fault found in him. And they probably asked a lot of people and turned over a lot of rocks. Then these men said, "We shall not find any charge against this Daniel unless we find it against him concerning the law of his God." In other words, they realized Daniel is such a good person, but he's very religious. The only thing we can get him on is his religion. What a tribute to Daniel. You're talking about a tribute to his righteousness. It's almost an admission. This guy is really a good administrator, a righteous guy, an honest guy. But, his religion is not like most of our pagan religions. We'll have to get him on his religion, because we know he follows his religion religiously. If ever that happened to any of us, someone wanted to attack us, but they could find no obvious faults, not a whole lot of problems, and they said the only thing we can attack them on is their religion, do you realize that would be, in the context in which I'm saying it, that would be to your honor, your credit? We can't throw rocks at you for all your other issues and problems, only your religion. So if ever that happens to you, they're attacking you on religious doctrine only, that's to your credit. They can't say, "He is mean as a snake, and he steals, and he lies," and whatever other thing they're going to say. what to his credit. Daniel 6:10. So they cooked up this religious legal trap to get Daniel in, and they, of course, applied to the king's vanity. Well, you want a loyalty oath. You want to know everybody's loyal to the Persian Empire and to your rulership, and because we believe, at least the commentators believe, they had had some rebellions and some problems, so they had a little bit of logic they could use, but that wasn't their real motive. Their real motive was to get Daniel. And then they got the king to sign it with his little royal ring. verse 10. Now when Daniel knew that the writing was signed, because Daniel heard about it, I'm sure, he went home. And in his upper room, with the windows open toward Jerusalem, like he always did, praying to where the temple was, he knelt down on his knees three times that day, prayed and gave thanks to God. He didn't cry. He gave thanks to God. It's interesting. He didn't cry, oh, whoa, it's me. They're out to get me. I mean, I'm sure he realized they're out to get him, but he still gave thanks before his God, as was his custom since his early days. I guess ever since he was a teenager, probably 15, 16, 17, 18, he's been doing that, which is a wonderful thing. And by the way, you wonder, why is he doing it toward where the temple was in Jerusalem? God told them when Solomon made the temple, if you ever have any crisis, come to this temple, which figuratively represents the throne of God, and pray to God. And that's what Daniel was doing. Verse 11, and these men assembled, I'm sure they were outside Daniel's window with spy glasses or whatever version they could get in those days, assembled and found Daniel praying and making supplication before his God. And they went before the king and spoke concerning the king's decree. Have you not signed a decree that every man who petitions any god or man within 30 days, except you, O king, shall be cast into the den of lions? That's pretty scary stuff. The king answered and said, the thing is true, according to the law of the Medes and Persians, which does not alter. Notice, once the king signed it into law, it had to stay. They couldn't alter it, couldn't change it. Even the king couldn't change it, all because they were jealous of him. By the way, if you read verse 7, they lied to the emperor. They told him that all the governors, you know, big administrators have signed off on it. They all had except for one, Daniel. They did this behind Daniel's back. But they didn't tell the emperor that, because they told him all in verse 7. They're very clever. And, you know, bad guys are often very clever in what they do. Now, here's what I think is true. I think the scriptures back it up. And maybe as the years go on, we'll understand it better. Daniel had a choice. When he realized what was going on, he could say, I can alter my worship of God to the inner room where nobody can see me, maybe cut off all the lights and block off the windows. Nobody can see what I'm doing, there's nothing against that by any means. Or I could keep doing what I'm doing. I think Daniel was more concerned with how it would look to God than how it would look to all those politicians in the Persian Empire. And I think Daniel said to himself, I think it would be appeasement to religious intolerance, persecution, paganism, etc., if I give in to them and have to hide my prayer life, like being ashamed of being a Christian because it's not in. We were just listening to some Christian news. I forgot the guy's name, but he was saying for younger people, 35 and under, it's not cool to be a Christian anymore. It's not cool to believe in the Bible. And actually, he was critical of many churches, which he says have not been defending the Bible, have been kind of weak-kneed on the Bible. And really, I think, I'm not saying you have to push your religion in other people's face and offend them, but being ashamed, you know, Christ said, if you're ashamed of me, I'll be ashamed of you before the Father. I think that was the way Daniel was thinking. If that makes any sense. And he said, I am not going to alter my behavior, because he was worried about how it would look to God. He would be appeasing the anti-God forces. verse 14, Daniel 6, verse 14. And the king, verse 14, chapter 6, when he heard these words, was greatly displeased with himself. He was displeased with himself. He knew he had been tricked. He realized Daniel wasn't in on this. They didn't go through him because it was, he instantly knew it was a trap for Daniel. Didn't take, and these guys were probably pushy and aggressive. And he could clearly see their jealousy. We want to get Daniel out of the way. Let the lions eat him up. And then one of them would, they hoped, get his position. Anyway, he was greatly displeased with himself because he let these guys trick him. And he set his heart on Daniel to deliver him. He labored till going down to the sun to deliver him. So all night he was looking for some legal loopholes he could get Daniel out of it. But by the laws of the Medes and the Persians, there's no way he could do it. So he tells Daniel, I hope your God can save you from the lions. He fasted all that night. Think about that. All that night for Daniel. And we got in the morning, he said, Daniel, was your God able to save you from the mouth of the lions? And Daniel answered him, and whoa, the king was happy, but he was also impressed with the God of Daniel. And you probably know the story, the plotters. He was mad the guys that plotted. He had all of them thrown to the lions. And just to prove that Daniel, I think God did this, just to prove that the lions didn't need Daniel because they weren't hungry, the moment they threw those other guys in there, they didn't even make it to the bottom of the cage, and they were ripped apart. The lions just ripped, I mean, you had to just think about it, but those lions were hungry. God's angel closed their mouth and wouldn't let them touch Daniel. It was a great victory for God's reputation, for all true believers. I'm sure it was good for all the other Jews and worshipers of the true God in the Persian Empire. Daniel had resisted the legal trap. He had won a great victory. Daniel 6:25. Then King Darius wrote, and this is to everybody in the empire, to all peoples, nations, languages that dwell on all the earth, peace be multiplied to you. I make a decree that in every dominion of my kingdom, men must tremble and fear before the God of Daniel. For he is the living God, the steadfast forever. His kingdom is one which shall not be destroyed, and his dominion shall endure to the end. Wow, think about that. And everybody in the empire had to respect Daniel's God. And I'm not going to read Ezekiel 4:24-5:2, but I want to just, there's another example of this. In Ezekiel 5:24-5:2, the Israelites had come back to Jerusalem after exile, and they'd start the temple. Then their neighbors, which included the Arabs and Samaritans and others around them, threatened them and got some political pull, and they were told they had to stop building the temple. And they stopped for a number of years. And then some prophets, many of them are, because of the shortness of their books, they're called minor prophets. And you can read all their names in the book there. Start telling them, look, it looks to God like you are putting him secondary in your own home, you know, while you build up your own houses, and his house lies in ruins, or half built, you know, I call it in ruins. Kind of embarrassed them and goaded them, and in spite of the fact that they didn't have the legal go-ahead, just because they wanted to do what God wanted them to do, they started to rebuild the second temple. And while the second temple wasn't as great as the first one, many of them cried because it was smaller, apparently not as glamorous as Solomon's temple and the amount of gold, etc. That temple was great because Jesus Christ taught in that temple. And in a sense, that made it even greater. And I believe the Jewish nation, at least some of them, I know the Jews are divided. I think the fact that they haven't rebuilt the third temple means that they're putting God secondary. And I understand the political pressure they're under and all that sort of thing. And someday something will happen and shock them into thinking, we got to put God first, and they're going to build that third temple. I believe it will happen. But they ought to look at it, how does it look to God that they're not doing? It's like they were appeasing their enemies. So they went on and built that second temple. And as you know the story, they got legal protection, and the new emperor actually demanded that the governors on the other side of the Euphrates give them all the wood and materials and animals they needed to make it great. So it turned out to be a blessing because they resisted the anti-God forces and did the good fight and stood up for God. I want to tell you a corny story. It's not original, but I still like it anyway. It's called Ready Aim. A bishop and a priest and a deacon were caught witnessing for the Christian God in a certain part of the middle of the world where if they don't allow Bibles, they don't allow Christianity, and if they catch you. So the authorities caught them, and they said, we're going to put you in front of a firing squad to teach people you can't be witnessing and preaching any of this Christianity in this part of the world. So, the soldiers lined up with their rifles, and they're all pointing first at the bishop. And the guy says, ready, aim, and the bishop yells, earthquake! And all the soldiers jump and hide, and he jumps over the fence and runs off. So then they pull up the priest, and the sergeant of the guard has a guy pull up their rifle. He says, ready, aim. And, of course, the priest yells, tornado, big storm. And they all run for cover. He jumps over the fence, and he runs off. Then they pull up the deacon. Deacon has gotten the wind of, what to do now. So the sergeant says, ready, aim. And the deacon yells, fire. Well, fire didn't get them to run and hide. That's the, double anyway. So the deacon didn't make it. Well, they fired their rifles. But, they said, if you got to explain a joke, it's not good. I'm using that joke to say we need to learn spiritual wisdom. The deacon didn't get it. Not well enough. We need to learn wisdom. And wisdom is a tough thing. There is a time when you shouldn't resist the government. Even the Roman Empire. I'm going to go to Romans 13. By the way, everybody, normally when people think of the Roman Empire, they think of evil. But I was listening to a famous historian. Now, this is what he said. I guess everybody has their own opinion. Much of the time of the Roman Empire, especially with Caesar and Augustus Caesar and many of the better emperors, Rome had low taxes. Relatively, and now you had to pay them or else. But they had low taxes, and they had good commerce, and actually much of the world, well, from Scotland all the way through to the Middle East and all of North Africa and a good chunk of Europe, well into Central Europe, was all under one government. Actually, they had highways, and some of the highways are still used that looped all the way around the Mediterranean. I mean, and most of the time they kept the sea pirates at bay. Every now and then they'd burst out. So you could ship by sea or by land. And that's why the gospel could spread in the Roman Empire, because they allowed freedom of religion. Now there were times when they had problems, and Nero, and we're mentioning there are exceptions to that rule. So and sometimes emperors did bad things. So I'm qualifying my answer. But notice what Paul writes to the Romans regarding civil government. And by the way, I think you can apply this to any government which maintains reasonable law and order. By the way, Christ even told them when they were trying to trick him with the coins. Also, I didn't know this. The Roman Empire made a number of concessions when they took Judea into the empire at the behest of some Jewish leaders who wanted more peace and order than what they had before. They made concessions to Judaism. I don't remember all the details, but they made a number of them. Like, for instance, they didn't have the emperor's picture on those Roman standards that all the armies had. They didn't do that. The legions there were in the Middle East because it would look to the Jews like idolatry. They made a number of them, so they weren't all that bad most of the time. Though they did have a few bad emperors, and that's maybe another story for another time. So here's what Paul wrote to the Romans. But since it was written and canonized, it applies to all of us too. Romans 13:1, let every soul be subject to the governing authorities, for there is no authority except from God, and the authorities that exist are appointed by God. In other words, God has allowed civil authority to exist. By the way, the Roman Empire lasted 700 years and brought most of the time law, order, and prosperity to the civilized world of its day. Well, maybe except for China, which was civilized far away, but most of the world was under Roman influence. That's really quite a good record on the whole. And if you look at that term, in other words, we might get mad about who wins the elections or who gets inherited a kingship or who gets to be the dukes or earls, you know, all these different authorities in the world. God has allowed it, so we have to cooperate. You may not like your local sheriff or the state trooper or the police officer or the mayor, but according to the Bible, you should respect their office and cooperate with them because they're in authority. And it's better to have authority than, you know, if, for instance, if all the police forces just quit, and maybe some other judges and other magistrates just quit, you realize within 6 months we'd have chaos. In some cities it'd be so out of control, it would be, well, I won't tell, it'd be bad, believe me. So you need that. For there is no authority except from God, and the authorities that exist are appointed by God. Therefore, whoever resists the authorities resists the ordinance of God, and those who resist will bring judgment on themselves. Even if your taxes are too high, pay them anyway. And that's, you know, a lot of people complain about, you know, the American Revolution and the British. Relatively speaking, the colonies actually had lower taxes when they were part of the British Empire than we have now. Now we've had many, many years of our own government. And that's another story. But, and I also, someone mentioned this in the podcast. There's some people that are so diplomatic and so wise. Like you go into your boss and you want something and he tells you no, but he's so smooth and diplomatic about how he says no, you end up liking him and thanking him. We need to be more like that. When we do have to tell somebody, unless you see it like Daniel, an affront to God, unless you think that's it, they may just be misguided. They don't know what they're doing. And they tell you, we want you to attend this religious celebration, and you don't want to do it. You might let them know that you are Christian and say that in a positive, general way. And for various and sundry reasons, you're not going to attend, but you're not attacking them. You're not being evil or mean. You're going to be nice, try to make friends, and stay on their good side because they probably don't know any better than what they're doing. And be polite, because I think that would be what God would want. It'd be the wise thing. It would be the smart thing to do. You can always, in other words, there's a time to fight and there's a time not to fight. And also, in all the cases in Daniel where the four young men stood up to actually three different emperors at different times, they still remained friends with those men and worked for them afterwards because they were polite and tactful and diplomatic. And many of us need to be smarter. And I'm talking to myself here. We need to be more diplomatic, more polite. Even when we have to say no, say in such a way that they want to thank us for saying no. I want to turn to Acts 5. this is an example when it's clear that you have to fight, you have to resist. But there's something here that I think is worth our taking note of. Acts 5, verse 27. By the way, in this story, the context of it, Christ has been crucified. And the Pharisees thought they got rid of all that. But then his 12 apostles start preaching in the temple, and they fill the entire city of Jerusalem with the gospel, and everybody's excited about it. They're converting thousands of people. And instead of, from their perspective, instead of one Christ to worry about, now they got 12, and they're in the, and they're good. These guys know what they're talking about. They're doing fabulous miracles. Like Peter will walk down a road, a walkway toward the temple. His shadow crosses sick people and are healed. Wow. You know, that, and other miracles that you'll see listed there. And the Pharisees are scared. We got to stop the guy. So they arrest Peter and John and put them in prison overnight. And the next morning, they want to bring them, you know, before them so they can intimidate them. And the guy, the guards say, we went to the prison. It's locked tight, but they're out of there. They're in the temple preaching again. They say, what? So they, after they finish preaching, they have the guards bring them over again. and then that's where the story picks up. Verse 27. When they had brought them, they set them before the council. Probably all these guys on a high raised bench looking down at those two guys. That's how I picture it. And the high priest asked them, saying, did we not strictly command you, you know, the other night, not to teach in the name of Jesus Christ? And look, you fill Jerusalem, the whole city, with your doctrine. That was everybody's talking about. And you intend to bring this man's blood on us. Well, they are the ones that, that demanded that the Romans execute him. Actually, you know, in fairness to the Roman governor, he did not want to execute Christ. He could see the jealousy. But because they were trying to appease the Jewish local authorities, which the Romans tried to do, they went on with it. But they actually didn't want to do it. These guys insisted. And now, of course, they're ducking and dodging. You know, that's how people are. And Peter makes this great statement of verse 29, which we've often probably mentioned. Peter says, and the other apostle, we ought to obey God rather than man. In other words, if you get a choice between obeying God or obeying the authorities, you obviously have to choose obeying God. You know, there's no, that's not an iffy kind of situation, you know, when to resist, when to fight, or when not. To fight or not to fight is a clear-cut decision. Verse 40 of Acts 5, verse 40, and they agreed with him, and when they called the apostles and beat them, those, they probably had a guy with a rod, and they probably got so many whacks, we might call it a really tough spank on their back. So they still, they were maybe, didn't think it was wise to kill them, but they were really mad. They beat them, verse 40. And then they commanded that they should not preach in the name of Jesus. And they let them go. As they departed from the presence of the council, rejoicing, this is John and Peter now, rejoicing that they were counted worthy to suffer for the name of Christ. Now, that's a great attitude. They just taken maybe 10, 20, 30 whacks on the back with a big rod, and they were happy. Because they knew that they weren't suffering because of any stupidity they did with their mouth or other mistakes. They were suffering purely because they were preaching Jesus Christ. If we're doing something for Jesus Christ or what Christ wants us to do, and we have to suffer for it, we can try to be like those men. Rejoice. Rejoice that you are found worthy to suffer for the name of Christ, because they will be elevated by God because of what they just did, and they're going to be elevated in God's estimation. But when we choose to resist, use wisdom, diplomacy, and respect for authority, and then think wisely about to fight or not to fight.